Okay, here we go. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Forgotten Feminists or the Yasmin Muhammad podcast. Today we have Sarah Edmondson. Sarah is a very brave survivor of the Nexium cult, and she has an amazing book called Scarred. And I'm going to reach back and get it because I just realized that I forgot to hold it up. But before we delve into Sarah's, activism as a whistleblower of the Nexium cult, we need to acknowledge what's happening in the world right now, especially since Sarah grew up Jewish and I grew up Muslim. And so with the big war that's happening right now between Israel and Gaza, it's really important for us to take a moment and to just talk about that. And later on in the episode, we're going to talk about how Hamas and how the cult mentality of Hamas and other Islamic terrorist groups contribute to them being able to do such atrocious things. But before we get into that, Sarah, I just wanted to check in and see how you're doing right now with all of this.
I'm literally gripping the table so hard, just trying to not break down. Like I said to you when we first were chatting privately, I feel like in many ways it's better that we're doing this on Zoom because if it was in person, I feel like I would just want to hug you and I would break down in tears because I just feel so helpless, so gutted, so devastated. And not just for, quote, my people, for the world. For the children, for all the innocent people. And I almost called this off because I didn't think I'd have the strength to do it. But I feel it's important. And also, the irony is not lost on me, given our backgrounds, that here we are joined in this bizarre way with our very different and yet very similar backgrounds. So it seemed fitting. And if it's raw and messy and I say the wrong thing, I think it's still better to do it and to start creating bridges and mend whatever division we are capable of, which may not be much, but it's better than nothing.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I feel that you and I are probably maybe bringing hope to the future to show that, because I think that the whole world is watching and they've really dehumanized both Israelis and Palestinians and are kind of watching this all like it's a video game. They can remove themselves in a way that you and I can't. And it's important to remind the world that there are people that are being raised in both of these Abrahamic religions, and they can come together and support each other and nurture each other and heal each other. And we are not enemies just because of, we're whatever, expectations of us. I have to talk about us both being Canadian. We're both actually from the same city of Vancouver, and how devastating it was for me to watch all of the pro-Hamas rallies happening in the cities, like every major city across our country. I can't even begin to imagine what that would feel like for you as a Jewish Canadian woman.
Well, I'm not there right now. I'm in Atlanta. I left a year ago, but from what I've seen on the news and what I've heard from friends and family in Toronto and Vancouver specifically, is where most of my family is. A lot of people are really scared and shocked that this is the world response and that there's so much division, even in my friend group and my family group. Like, I don't know how much what the right word to use anymore because even the word woke, I feel like, has changed a million times since it became a thing. But I guess what's important is that to know in terms of, my journey is that my family, I've always identified as being very left wing, very liberal, New Democrats, liberal, like left. And that's, I just can't, I don't even know how to have the conversation with so many people that I know who are, who tend to, you know, root for the underdog, not understanding the difference between the plight of the Palestinians and the goals of Hamas. And I'm very confused. I feel like I'm shocked. Floundering. I'm shocked, and I'm still so rocked by what's happened. I don't really have the strength to debate or talk about it yet. You know, it's like,
of course,
I want to. All I can do is like forward podcasts that I feel are helpful and be like, hi, you might want to listen to this, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm hoping, like, I'm watching it all kind of shake out, kind of like after what happened with BLM and the, you know, actually, I am going to say something, and you can delete this if you want.
I will never delete it. Go ahead.
This is the one thing that I'm just, and tell me if this isn't off perspective, but one thing that struck me as a major sort of inconsistency of what I'm seeing right now is that when the Black Lives Matter movement first kicked off, like when it first was a thing, and there were people that I knew and celebrities and people of power and people that have influence or whatever were saying things and trying to like be supportive and said things like, of course, Black Lives Matter, like all lives matter. And then that was very clearly shut down as no. No, you saying that is gaslighting us and taking attention away from what needs to be talked about right now, which is that Black lives need to matter and they haven't been mattering in the way that they need to. And then people like myself were like, I don't know what to say. I was trying to be like, I almost said that, and then someone else said it, and they're like, okay, well, I can't say that. And I see that right now when the atrocities that happened in Israel perpetrated by Hamas, people were saying, you know, things like, I stand with Israel, or I support my Israeli friends if they don't support the government or whatever. And then people saying, well, what about this? And what about the lives of, of course those people matter. Of course those children matter. What are you, like a inhumane animal? Of course. But right now we're talking about what just happened. You know what I mean? So it feels like the left that would be supportive of BLM can't do that here. That's just one thing that I'm just sort of grappling with. Does that make sense?
100% makes sense. In fact, I was speaking with a friend of mine who is in a bomb shelter in Israel, who said to me almost verbatim what you just said. And she also told me that the Black Lives Matter Twitter page had shared a picture, like this drawing of a person in like a paragliding thing, and they had him like as a hero. They said something about like some anti-colonial hero or whatever. So getting it very, 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 very wrong, you know. The fact that you have to explain, like the fact that you have to, how do I say this, like prove your humanity, like prove your worth, like prove that you don't deserve to die, or that you don't, or that literally Jewish lives matter. Literally, that's what we're talking about here. Like the fact that you have to fight for that, or that you have to constantly be repeating that, or that you have to even be put in the position where you feel that people are even questioning that, you know, like we've put, and a lot of these Black Lives Matter, those kinds of, which is another cult, which we could talk about later. A lot of these groups are very, it's all about divisive. It's all about oppressor, oppressed, good, the bad, Black, white. And that is not reality. That's not how humanity works. And, but you're absolutely correct when you say it's not the time, it's not the place. In fact, I was feeling the exact same way, because I have written a few op-eds about my dad, who is from Gaza, born and raised in Gaza. And his whole life, he dreamed of Gaza going back to the way it was before Yasser Arafat, basically, before the Muslim Brotherhood or Hamas took over. He, you know, was overrun with terrorists, and he just really wanted it to have some semblance of a civil government, the way it did when it was under Israel and Egypt and the Ottomans and the British before that. And I have a very, I had a very difficult relationship with my dad. Like I had a, if you have read my book, so you know, but when this whole thing happened, I felt such a sense of heartbreak for him because I knew how hurt he would be and how sad he would be to see his homeland completely demolished. Yeah. And when I was asked to write about that, I actually ignored the messages at first because I thought, this isn't the time. Mm-hmm. Like, this literally is not the time. We're talking about Israeli babies being burned and decapitated. Like, I can't talk about my dad right now and how sad he would be over losing Gaza. Mm-hmm. And then it was actually my Israeli friends who I was speaking to who said, no, actually, you should talk about this now, because now is the time to point the finger in the right direction, because the whole world is going, Israelis are the bad guys and Palestinians are the, or actually Hamas are the victims in this scenario. And so it's important to have a voice from sort of the Palestinian side pointing the blame in the right direction. And so that's why I did it.
Well, the irony is, not, I mean, there's again, so many parallels with our vastly different content-wise story, but the irony is not lost on me that, you know, our backgrounds hated each other, you know, our cultures hated each other and wanted to not, you know, all of each, but the extreme levels of both wanted to annihilate the other. And here we are on a Saturday, on a Shabbat, which I don't keep. I'm not religious. Mm-hmm. Having this conversation live, which is scary, but we can do the best we can. And back to what you were just saying about the division, the divisive goal of many, many groups, not just BLM, but since we're talking about cults, the divisive goal is to other the other.
Yes, right? Exactly.
To make
dehumanize.
Dehumanize. Mm-hmm. To make it okay to even consider hurting, never mind decapitating, mm-hmm. among other things, right? So how does it get there? And part of it is that it's an indoctrination to think that the other mm-hmm. person is less than, and we are. Like, I'm embarrassed to say that the Jews have said that we are the chosen people. I don't say that as a Jew. I don't say that. I think that's crazy. We're all on this earth. We all breathe the same air. Chosen by who? Like, I have to tell you something that I've come to terms with, and I'm sure that I'm going to offend many people that I know that are Jewish, but I'm just putting it out there, that it wasn't until I studied cultic dynamics and learned about all these extreme religions, specifically even Christian, because I learned more about Christianity first, like evangelical Christians, the Mormons, the Jehovah's Witness, in my mm-hmm. cultic journey, right? Every single one of these leaders are like, okay, I have a direct line to God, all right? So, you know, I've been speaking to Jesus, or I've been, you know, so God, like literally, I just got off the phone with God, and he said, I need to marry Tammy. I mean, she's only 11, but I mean, God said, and I'm like, what? Like, people around them are going, oh, you spoke to God and God said, do that. And I'm laughing because it's so absurd, right? And I'm kind of like having these awarenesses about how all these groups are built on this fundamental belief that somebody could do that, even that somebody can mm-hmm. talk to God and God is giving them messages. And like in certain religions, that's more extreme than others, right? Specifically right now, the Mormon Church, FLDS, like Warren Jeffs with a, you know, 80 brides or that he had, he's like, well, I'm he's the conduit. He's a prophet. They believe they can get messages from God. Like, well, how do you know that that's not just his own perversion? And he's saying God said it. Like, why do people believe this? Right. And recently I was at a very reform, super casual bat mitzvah of a dear friend of mine, and her daughter was getting bat mitzvahed. And they were saying some of the prayers that I've heard many times because I had a bat mitzvah. And I said to my husband, and mind you, I had a gummy. So I was like thinking.
That's the best time to go to a bat mitzvah.
Right? You got to. I mean, I do love my gummies. It's helped me a lot in my trauma recovery. But I turned to him and I go, I've been to so many these things. I've sat in synagogue. Like my parents, like so, just background, like my dad was raised Anglican. His dad was an Anglican minister. My mom was raised Jewish, but like super reform. God wasn't a term used in my home by either one. Both of them, like I celebrated Christmas. We lit a menorah. Mm-hmm. I have stocking.
Very cool.
You know, like
so Canadian of you.
So Canadian. So Canadian, liberal, hippie yeah. parents. Like, and I love my life. But I have to tell you yeah. that it's sitting in synagogue and hearing the stories and God said to, you know, Moses or whatever, I never ever like took any of that very seriously. Like these are stories and you can learn some good messages from them. I never feared God. I never thought like, I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is I just had this recognition that I never resonated in terms of like took on a belief system that I now see is so prevalent in all of these groups. Would that have been different if I'd been raised by, you know, ultra right wing Orthodox Jews? I don't know. That's not how I was raised.
Mm-hmm. You know, but you can relate to it because of your personal experience, right? Yes. So this is Sarah's book here. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so like, I didn't buy into that belief system,
mm-hmm.
but I bought into a cult belief system when I was 27. And I have no blame for my parents because I'm sure they'll hear this eventually. But I do think my kind of like, go figure it out and like, let's introduce you to so many different things in some ways made me a little susceptible because I did want rules for life. I did want a path to latch onto, to something to tell me like how to be a, not necessarily a good person, but like I wanted the playbook. I wanted the secrets to living. You know, I wanted a way to figure out how to be the best version of myself. And so a lot of people get that from religion. I found it in a personal and professional development program, for those who don't know my story, which ended up to be a cult, but we didn't figure that out for 12 years. So anyway, there's the segue for you. Go
ahead. Yeah, no, that's a perfect segue. Thank you for setting it up for me.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you for checking in, by the way.
Absolutely. We're going to talk more about that when I come on your podcast, but I'm going to give you a break now because I know how emotionally draining it is. And like you said, we're in the middle of it. We're in the eye of the tempest right now. This is not the time to really be able to have any kind of distance to have any conversations about it. It's too raw. It's happening around us right now. But you did touch on some really important things. Obviously, religion, you know, plays part in what's going on. And, you know, sometimes cults within religions, like you talked about Mormonism, you talked about Scientology, I think you mentioned, and I mentioned Hamas. So it's like there's layers to this. And the reason why you relate to all of these things is because you've done a lot of work and a lot of healing and a lot of understanding about cult behavior and a lot of educating about cults. In fact, I'm going to have to tell you now that I have an organization called Free Hearts, Free Minds that supports people who have renounced Islam and are living in Muslim majority countries. And I got to meet one of the women who went through my program, and she was absolutely over the moon that I was going to have the Sarah Edmondson on my podcast. She said that you are the reason why she realized that she was in a cult.
No.
And so you changed her life.
Oh my God.
And from you, she learned about Dr. Stephen Hassan And then it just all unraveled from there.
No way.
I have
goosebumps.
So she, you know, when we met, she really wanted to make sure that I told you. And I said, I absolutely would tell you because you need to know that. You need to know that what you're doing is making a difference in people's lives. You're transforming people's lives. And I'm really, really grateful for what you do because I know how difficult it is to put yourself back into that darkness, you know, and risk re-traumatization and talking about all of these things. And one of the things that I want to touch on before I touch on it, I want to get a background from you. But one of the things that I really want to talk about is forgiveness, like forgiving yourself, because I know that's something that I had to do a lot of work on. So I want to talk to you about that. But before that, I want to just get you to give us a bit of a background. I know this is going to be hard to do. You've got a whole book. You've got two seasons of an HBO series describing this whole thing. And here I am asking you to like succinctly and concisely describe to me the Nexium cults.
I got so you. I've got it down to a small elevator pitch because moving to a new city, I've had to explain it really quick because people have an attention span of a fly. And before I do, I just want to say I really appreciate you sharing that because you're right. It is difficult. It is dark, but knowing that is like what fuels me. It really is.
Yeah.
And please tell her thank you. And if you can connect me, I'd love to tell her that personally.
She would be over the moon. I will. Absolutely.
So for those who don't know my story, I'm Canadian. In fact, I think that we grew up. What do you mind me asking how old you are?
I don't like to share information that yes. might give right. people opportunity to find right. out like any kind of demographic, right. you know, specific That's information fine. Like that. I'm hiding yeah. from the jihadis, as you know.
Oh, right.
But I'll say I'm in my 40s.
Yes. So I'm also in my 40s and we grew up in Vancouver. And I feel like, you know, we could have passed each other at Jericho Beach. You know what I mean? Or we could have seen each other.
Oh, you would have seen me, Sarah. I'd be the one covered head to toe in black. And I was not near Jericho Beach.
Oh, no.
But yeah, okay. I hear what you're saying.
But we were near each other in the 80s, you know, and that's wild to me. I mentioned my parents were social activists, hippies, marching for peace across the Burrard Street bridge. I always wanted to be a, I always had goals of making the world better. And I know this is going to sound so trite right now, but I've always had this burning desire to somehow affect peace, specifically in the Middle East. I even wrote a play about it when I was 27, 28, about the Middle East crisis, and had these sort of altruistic, idealistic visions of myself somehow participating in that in some way. No idea it might look like this. But we'll cut to that later. I was an actress in my 20s. I was an aspiring actress. I was not where I wanted to be. I wanted to have meaning in my life and have purpose. My goal was to be famous enough to have a platform to have influence for all these big idealistic goals. Wasn't there. I saw a film called What the Bleep Do We Know? Met the director of this film at a film festival who said, well, if you like my film... And his film was really about shifting consciousness, and it did so through the media. So I thought if I could be a part of that, then I could have more impact and blah, blah, blah. And he told me about a training that I took, and I'm going to try to condense this into an easy soundbite. But the long story short, it went from a personal and professional development program. That's what I thought, a system where you could update your limiting beliefs, be the best version of yourself, and join Team Humanity. The goal of this organization was to... again, make the world better, to heal the wounds between warring nations, to elevate people's consciousness and to be more integrated so that we wouldn't hurt each other. This was the goal. So it seemed very in line for me. And I spent 12 years there. Many, many red flags along the way that I didn't understand what I was looking at. Knowing what I know now, I wouldn't have even signed up, let alone sat through the first 5-day training, knowing how groups can indoctrinate people for their own gain, not for the gain of the participants. Cut to 12 years later. Oh, how do I summarize this part? There's some really bad things that happened that we could no longer ignore. And I was able to wake up when I realized that the mark on my body, which I was told was going to be a tattoo to be a part of a secret society, was actually the initials of the leader in a cryptic monogram. And that was the thing that snapped me back to reality. Obviously, a lot of things happened between being a coach in a leadership program, ended up in a, you know, physical scarring of my body that the book gets into in great detail because it's very complicated to explain. But that led to us going to the authorities. They didn't understand what they were looking at. I think you've been through that as well. We can discuss. So we decided to go to the media. I was on the front page of the New York Times showing the scar, which led to an investigation, which led to Keith Raniere being extradited from Mexico, which led to a 6-week trial, 4-hour deliberation, and 120 years in prison. Wow. So that's where we are now. Or that was 6 years ago, or 4 years ago. We've been out for 6 years. All of this was captured in a docuseries called The Vow, and that came out during COVID. So we'd stopped acting, my husband and I, and we decided to continue the conversation with a podcast. So now we do a little bit culty. We do that full time, and we look at organizations and groups and talk to people, survivors, experts about their experience in all sorts of coercive control and high demand groups. So that's why we're excited to have you on, because we actually have not yet touched on radical Islam.
And I've been too afraid. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. And I'm just going to reiterate to everybody again, the series is called The Vow. And there are 2 seasons and it's on HBO as well. Sarah's book here, it's called Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, The Cult That Bound My Life. And here she is on the cover showing the branding that they did on her. So as you were speaking, I was reminded of a really poignant quote, and I'm not sure if it was Bonnie or if it was Mark who said it, but they said, nobody joins a bad thing. Like nobody joins a cult. It was Mark. Yeah. He was saying, like, because what you were talking about, like, this is all about peace and, you know, bettering yourself and bettering the world. And they come at you with all of these positive messages, and that's what pulls you in. And that reminds me of the cult that I grew up in. And when we're looking at Hamas and what's going on right now, and as many of you know, my ex was also a terrorist like these Hamas people. And he believed that he was doing a good thing. He believed that this was, you know, how to be the best of humanity. And of course, the thing that one of the things that would make them such great people is to eradicate all Jews off the earth. So it's right. Pretty shocking for anybody who is not indoctrinated in that darkness to hear that sentence. But for them, they truly think that they are doing a good thing. It's jarring, but I have no, like, I'm not talking about those kinds of cults right now, but I'm going to talk about what you and I have been through. And I want to go back to the idea of forgiveness, because there is a lot of things that I said and did to myself first and foremost, that I look back and I'm like, what, how did I do that? Like, and the Dr. Stephen Hassan, who is somebody who you're very familiar with, has this topic where he talks about your authentic self and how you had to, like, be this persona in order to survive. And that was really helpful to me, because yes, it made me realize, like, oh, good. So I'm not a bad person. I just had to do bad things, or I had to act like I believed or agreed with bad things, because that's what I needed to do to survive.
It was a mask.
It was a mask.
Yeah. The cult identity, and literally at a certain point, a piece of fabric over your body. Mm-hmm. Right. Which probably made it easier. In fact, I will just tell you, and I'll pump your tires more when you come on our podcast, but your book was so good. And I listened to it on Audible, because this is what I do. And my husband would find me in the bathroom or like in the bath or like in like changing, and he'd see me like weeping. He's like, "What is going on with you?" Because he can't tell I have the earbud in. And I'm like, I'm listening to your husband's story and I'm weeping with you and crying and like wanting to save you, like try to like get to, like go back in time and tell me where I am and get like go pull you out of that situation if I could.
So sweet.
But I also like, you know, it's people I think hear a story like yours who don't have this education and they might say like, well, why didn't you leave? And, you know, that's so crazy. How could you believe it? There's nothing that you shared in your book that I thought that. I was like, I get that. I get that how that happened. I understand why she did that. I get it. Like, I mean, I still wanted to intervene, but I understood it. And I think it is a really good point that both of us, I think, had an identity beforehand. And I think that's actually one of the reasons why you're able to do what you do now and why you're able to get yourself out. And tell me if this resonates, it's just my own interpretation of your book. But because you had freedom until you were six, because you had a taste of what life was like in your foundational experience of being a child, when things went south and terrible and abusive and extreme and religious and all the craziness that happened afterwards, you were comparing it to something that was actually better. Right. For you. And so I think that little, that flame, you know, stayed there, got covered and covered and covered more deeply, even till I think it was when you're 20, when you agreed to get married for your mother's attention and love, which failed. Right. But that was the reason. Again, I totally get it. The things that we do for love and attention and affection, that's a real wound. That's a real thing, which I'm sure you've done tons of work on. But yeah, just the concept of that consistency of, and this doesn't apply to people who are born into cults, right? I don't think. Like, I think when people are born into something like the Jehovah's Witness, or I don't know enough about radical Islam, but I will say that I had a free life before, right? And then I joined the cult, and it wasn't like all of a sudden, you know, all my rights and freedoms were taken away. It was a very slow burn. So I didn't see it happening. You know, I didn't see that I didn't have free will anymore because I was being lied to, you know, all these things that happened later, but my pre-cult identity was always there. And I love that about your book, because it's like, you're having the dialogue in your head, your authentic self and your, I don't know what you call it. Your
persona. Yeah.
Your persona, the mask. Right. So that's something that I think a lot of people who've been through this kind of thing can relate to, even if they weren't in a cult, even just being in an abusive relationship or a situation where it feels like they don't have choice to leave or bounded choice. Have you read Yanya Lalich's book? No? Hold on. Let me go to my little, this is the other. So Stephen Hassan and Yanya Lalich are the two books that I recommend probably the most when people get out, and it's called Take Back Your Life.
I'm familiar Audible. With the book.
Yes. I narrated the Audible because I was like, yeah, you need to get this in Audible format, because I just don't have the capacity. I mean, I have this book, but I've never read it. I only listen to things. I read it when I had to do the Audible, but I was like, why did I bring her up? What were we just talking about? I tangented.
We were talking about your authentic self and the persona. Oh.
Yeah, and yeah, get back to your life means like figuring out who that person
take back
is.
Your
oh,
life.
Yeah, oh yes, yeah. I know what she was gonna say. I say she has a term called bounded choice.
Yes, people, that's right.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, some people say, well, you have a choice. Most of the time, the choice is like if someone's got a gun to your head, do you really have a choice? The options are either do the thing or die. So if you're either going to do, like, you're going to get married to the man you don't love, or you lose everything. People don't get that when they're not bounded.
And tell me about a moment where you felt like that, because there were so many times. I mean, I mentioned that there was things that I did to hurt myself, and I know you did too, like the way they restricted your food and things like that. Like, were there moments where you felt like, okay, this is really off, but I'm bound to do this?
Mm-hmm. Probably, you know, to be honest, I didn't get, can I swear on this? Is this a swearing?
Yeah, of course. All the swearing you fucking want, man.
Fuck yes. I have a potty mouth. I What was I gonna say? Oh yeah, they didn't head fuck me that much. A lot of the people that were closer to Keith and like moved to Albany and got into the inner circle, because I lived in Vancouver. Albany's upstate New York, where the mothership
Right.
was.
You had a bit of distance.
I had some distance, and I think that they kind of left me alone because I was a funnel. I was a recruiter, and I was bringing so much fresh blood that it was better just to
Fresh
let me do my
money.
thing. Yeah, fresh money, fresh blood, fresh women for Keith. Literally, I was bringing all these beautiful actresses from Vancouver. And, you know, on a silver platter, not knowing what I was doing, because I was told he was celibate, by the way. Anyone who's watched these documentaries, I don't know if that's clear. They told us he was celibate because he didn't need sex because he was so enlightened. Cannot believe I believe that, but
I didn't know
I
that.
did.
I missed
Yeah.
that from the documentary.
Yeah. Some
Wow.
people who joined earlier than me didn't think that, but at some point in the mid-2000s, I think they were like, we better clean up his persona. And they sort of changed the narrative about him, and that helped, because then people wouldn't suspect it. What are all these women doing around him? Oh, they're his helpers. They're his, that's his assistant. This is executive board. It was a harem.
Ugh.
I know. I'm sorry, but you
They were
asked
the
me.
ones that got head fucked.
Yes. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I
They,
was
you asked me,
a
what was the
moment where
question?
you felt
Oh yeah.
stuck, like.
But the thing where I was most stuck, where it really came to a head, is with Joss. So this is the secret women's group where I was supposed to get the tattoo. And I was invited to that like just a few months before I ended up leaving. And I think that they knew that I was on my way out. Like I had a baby at this point and my values were shifting. That was more important to me. And they needed to like hook me back in. And that was the thing. And I didn't really understand till later that DOS was what Keith was creating. The leader was creating to maintain, maintain his harem through blackmail. So just to hear about DOS, just to hear about this women's group for empowered women that were going to hold each other accountable, which if it was what it said it was, it would have been great, but it wasn't. It was another lie, a bait and switch, which by the way, all these groups are. All these groups hold up like, you know, how many virgins in heaven if you do X, Y, and Z? If you do X, Y, and Z, you're going to be successful. It's all this illusion of hope, this dangled carrot of you're going to have blah, blah, blah in the afterlife or a mansion or whatever. Never going to happen. Man, my tangent thing is really throwing me off these today.
So you were saying that DOS was the moment, I guess
Oh,
that's
yeah.
the place where you felt
Thank you.
stuck.
Yeah, so
No worries.
I had agreed to join this thing. I gave collateral, which is had been a
Right.
normal thing in Nexium for a while. So they had collateral on me. They had a nude photo. They had a false confession, because people gave them things that they would keep to make sure you never spoke of it. It was supposed to be secret, like the Freemasons or whatever, and like a Freemason group for the women. And there was something appealing about that at first. That was, you know, the secret club, and we're gonna hold each other accountable and blah 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 blah. But anyway, cut to the night of the tattoo, which was to be my initiation ceremony into the secret sisterhood. It's not a tattoo and it's a brand. It's a, and just so people know that, but you saw on the cover of the book, it's like under the underwear line. So the probably the most sensitive skin on your body, without anesthetic. And it took quite some time to carve those lines into your body with a cauterizing iron. Everything in my body was saying, get the fuck out. This is not okay. This, like, people think we're a cult already. This is for sure not good. You know, like, and then I'm gaslighting myself, which you also explain so well in your book. In my mind, I'm going, you said you were committed. This is what women do. All the indoctrination that we'd been fed for the last 5 years about men and women and women's worst traits, because there was this whole like gender program that, again, we thought was good when it was really terrible. You know, I'm being flaky. I'm looking for the back door. And then I have Lauren, who's in my ear saying, you know, Lauren was my upper rank, like the person who brought me into DOS, and also my therapist and one of my best friends and the godmother of my children and the woman who married Nippy and I, like total trust in this woman. She would never ask me to do something that wouldn't be good for me. And she's saying to me, you know, you're a green sash. And I'm throwing a lot of things at your audience that may not know my story, but there's this hierarchy in Nexium of sashes, of colors, like martial arts. I'm a high rank, and everyone else in that room, my other sisters, were lower rank. So So I had to be a leader. I had to show them that I could push through it, that I could overcome pain and, you know, not be a pussy or whatever the fuck that means, you know. And all of these things are going on in my head. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it because I said I would. And then I'd go back. No, you get the fuck out of here. This is terrible. And then the collaterals held over my head. You committed to this. And part of the commitment of DOS was a vow of obedience. Thinking that the person who brought you in would never ask you to do anything that wasn't good for you. So I had a trust in Lauren that was, I mean, it's illogical, but in that system, it was logical. So yes, that was a moment where I felt completely bound. I was fucked if I did it, I was fucked if I didn't. In many ways, I'm glad that I did it because it's ultimately what woke me up. Like if they hadn't brought me into DOS, it might still be going.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like
that's right.
They really messed with the wrong person. We were able to shut down most of, excuse me, when we woke up, it was just before another round of branding was supposed to occur. And we were able to pretty much dismantle the organization, except for one small batch of women from Mexico who did it anyway, even though they'd heard what was going on. So, but we, yeah, there was, I think over 100 and about 130 women in DOS and 20 to 30 women got branded. So they were planning on branding everybody. And it had just gotten started. Like it had only been in action for a short period of time when we blew it up. So who knows where it would have gone.
Yeah, I didn't even know that it was 20 to 30 women. I didn't even know it was that the number was that high.
Yep.
So you mentioned Lauren. I have a million questions here and I haven't even touched on any of them. But now you mentioned Lauren and something that kind of you grazed by it in the documentary, which was something that took my breath away, was how after everything, like you said, she was your bridesmaid. She's the godmother to your child. She's your best friend. She's your therapist. She's your everything. Like you guys have a real sisterhood. And to find out that she was so indoctrinated to pull you into this. And instead of being angry at her, you actually wrote to the judge asking for them to reduce her sentence, which I thought was amazing. I mean, I can imagine doing something like that, like 10 to 15 years afterwards, you know, after you've had some time to think about it and forgive and understand and perspective, but like you were in the moment, this was all happening. The trial's going on, like they're going to Mexico, they're arresting Keith, like everything's just, and in that, yeah. All of that, you were able to take a step back and say, this girl deserves some mercy. Like, yeah, that's amazing.
Thank you. You know, in the timeline of it, a couple years had, I don't know exactly, I want to say maybe even 3 years had passed. Mm-hmm. So that may not have been clear with the timeline, 2 or 3 years at least. And in that time, I had done a lot of self-education. I'd read a lot. I'd listened to podcasts. I mean, we hadn't necessarily started our podcast yet, but I had talked to Stephen Hassan, Yanya Lalich. I had done my own therapy. And I just knew that she was a victim also, you mm-hmm. know, and that was never her intention. Actually, one of the things that Stephen Hassan says to people who are like, when he's helping to deprogram or to, you know, have people be aware that they're in a cult or a high demand group, is he says, you know, when you signed up, is what you're doing right now, is this what you signed up for? Like, did you sign up to have the leader's initials seared into your flesh? Right. And yeah. Like, of course I would have said no, because I, yeah. Who agrees to that? But again, frog in the pot of water. So with her, mm-hmm. I knew that's not what she signed up for. She wasn't, right. You know, she signed up to, she was 18 when she.
Right. And her mom was in it. So it was like, it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one thing about Keith is that he was able to really get his meat hooks into women when he got them at that age. Like I got in at 27, even though I was floundering and had low self-esteem and things like that, I was a more developed person. Mm-hmm. And I also had a really good relationship with my dad. And I think that prevented me from looking for a father figure in him, which I see with a lot of other women that got close to him. So with Lauren, and also like the trial, You keep in mind, I wrote that letter after the trial. So my perspective of Lauren changed when she took the stand. She took the stand, and because she took the stand, because she turned on him, right?
Yeah.
And until that moment, I was supposed to take the stand. So her taking the stand relieved me from being a witness. Because otherwise I would have had to go with a 6-week-old baby. Or no, wait, 2 or 3, very young, like a newborn. I would have to have gone and been like on stand. It would have been terrible. So I was grateful. And her testimony was truly the nail in the coffin. She was the star witness. And she put it all out there and she owned it. And, you know, it, when someone does that, like, how can I not forgive her? Like she, and she also wrote me, which actually happened after I forgave her, which made me like doubly, triply forgive her. But she wrote a really beautiful letter of apology and, you know, owned, you know, everything she did and why she did it. And was like, I mean, she's done a lot of work too.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That makes me happy.
Yeah. I haven't talked to her. I actually wrote to her lawyer. I've been asking for a year to be able to talk to her. But it's complicated with, there's a civil case and we have to do it through lawyers. But I know that one day we will have closure fully, but we've had a lot.
That's great. It's still admirable for you to be able to recognize that she was, you know, part of this cult and indoctrinated the same way you were. And, but yeah, at the end of the day, we're all victims. Like, we're all victims of whatever cult leader, you know, is leading us. And unfortunately, in a lot of these cases, it's women and children that end up being the biggest victims. In your cult, there weren't a lot of kids being affected, but that does seem to be a real common denominator. You were mentioning previously about, what's his name? Not Jim Jones, the other guy with the pastel wives.
Oh, Warren Jeffs.
Warren Jeffs.
Yeah.
you know, like it's women and kids, right? There were usually the ones that are first to be victimized by these egomaniac cult leaders. But yeah, you're absolutely correct. She not only joined so young, but I think the fact that her mom was in it must have been worse for her, because she really felt like it protected. Like, she felt like this couldn't be something bad if mom is such a big part of it. I mean, that's her mom, for goodness sake. So she's going to have to do some forgiving of her mom as well, I'd imagine.
Mm-hmm. She's just getting out of prison. Or I think she's already out. She's in a halfway house.
Ah, okay. Have you spoken to her? Because
No.
I was taken aback by a moment in the documentary where she says, "I'm even more mad at Sarah than I am at Keith." I was like, what did she just
say? I know. Like, I know. What?
You had every single ounce of right to send her that voicemail. Like, you were kind in that voicemail, but she was just so hurt.
Yeah.
Because the mirror, she didn't want to see the reality of what she had done.
And I still
that's
don't know
why
if
it was so painful to her.
Yeah. I still don't know if she has, but I'll tell you, most people never get to confront their abusers like face to face in that way. And I didn't. I left a voicemail, but I'm so glad that they used it, because like Jahan, the filmmaker, the director of The Vow, reached out before and said, like, is it okay if we use it? And I'm like, I haven't heard that in whatever it was, 4 years at the time. Sure. Like, I can't imagine why I wouldn't want you. And when it was on like a HBO docuseries, me telling her, what do I say? Like, wake the fuck up, or whatever the fuck I said. I was like, that was so vindicating. And literally there's people
raw.
Like, you're just raw. And like, you know, even at that time, we didn't even know what we were looking at. We just knew it was bad and wrong. We didn't know about the sex trafficking and the, you know, women being
locked
pseudo,
up in the house.
Like, locked up, not locked, whatever you want to call it. Like, the door was open, but she stayed there for 2 years. It's a mental prison, you know, all that stuff. We didn't even know. There was so much we didn't know about. the cages that they had bought.
Yeah.
For like, by the way, a little tangent. Rahul wrote, "Please, everybody, read Autobiography of a Yogi. I highly recommend it. I just have to tell you that Lauren asked me to read that book when I became a member of DOS. So I'm not going to read it, but if it's good for you, I'm very happy for you. And all of these things could be twisted by bad people. So be careful." So I don't remember. I don't even know what it's about. Like the guru disciple, right? Like the guru master disciple, I think that's what she wanted me to read it for.
But it's just tainted because of the
tainted,
person who was recommending it to you. So
yes.
Forget it. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Rahul, but I'm glad you find it helpful for the world.
So I, like I said, you know, I'm cognizant of the fact that you have your kids with babysitters. And so I want to be able to finish up on time, but I've only left
sure.
5 minutes for the participants to speak with you. So hopefully you can stay a little bit
yeah,
longer.
Yeah, no, we can stay till 1:30. That's fine. I may just,
okay.
Before we get into questions, I may take a quick bathroom break and then we can continue if that's okay.
Okay. Yeah. Why don't you go ahead and do that now? And we'll talk amongst ourselves.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Hi.
Hi, everyone. Good to see you. Hi, Ira. Hi, Lois.
I wanted to say off subject, thank you. It's wonderful to be among people of Muslim heritage who don't hate Jews at all and have completely put that out of themselves and even care about Jews. That is wonderful. Thank you so much. I do want to say something about cults, but I guess let's wait for a little bit culty to come back.
Yeah. So her name is Sarah. A Little Bit Culty is the name of her podcast, which is amazing. And obviously it's on the topic of cults and everything. But
yeah.
But thank you, Ira, for that. I think that in the
and there's
dark
my
and divisive
and there's my cult, as everyone
cult
knows.
Cult of cats.
That is my cult leader.
So Sarah's back now. Yes. So if you want to ask her what you were going to ask her.
Well, it's sort of like I have lived a long life studying ideologies and cults as one of my side subjects. And I'd love to be in touch with you about what I've learned about it. It's my own take and understanding of it. But there's a basic etymological thing, cult, cultivate, agriculture. They all come from the same root. Cult is something we cultivate because we love it. Culture comes from the same word. And so everything is a cult if it holds together. And then we have to distinguish malicious cults from virtuous cults. And that's very hard because there's no fine, precise dividing line. Every cult has some virtuous and some malicious in it. But there are different balances, very different balances. And one of the very sad things is that it's impossible for a cult to be completely virtuous or just to go off on a perfect, the more it loves itself, the more the vicious side is going to start coming out. Whereas to get trapped in the vicious side, that's easy.
Mm-hmm.
And for that to get worse and worse. So it's a very virtuous subject to keep examining that. I do political science and theory sometimes. David Hume, a great student of vicious circles in the mind and vicious factionalism or vicious cults, wrote a number of essays and things on this. And his Izzat distinction was meant to overcome the vicious circles in the mind and the cult behavior, but it didn't. James Madison got from Hume the idea that you divide into a number of cults or factions and make it pluralistic enough that they all balance each other and stop each other from getting out of hand. But that hasn't seemed to work out perfectly either, although it did have some virtues. And we do seem to have an overarching cult that has so many subcults. That someone brought up Black Lives Matter. It's a cult, but it's not Black people. It's an ideological cult that uses Black people to throw against society. And there's a theory called critical race theory. It is a subset of critical theory. Critical theory is the template for turning every cause into a hateful cult, which divides the world into the good and the bad, and suppresses the bad viciously on the argument that that is how to achieve toleration, by suppressing our enemies. And then it has a subcult for every field. There's critical gender theory. And there's the people who hate critical gender theory. And so they come up with gender critical theory, which is also a hate cult, but it's the oppressed one right now. And so there's some sympathy for it being oppressed, but nevertheless, in power, it would also be a hate cult. And there's critical, I don't know how many critical theories, critical age theory, critical this, everything. This is sort of like a mass template for vicious cults. But there are also so many virtuous cults. All of our societies are based on them. All cultures are. Problem is how to keep them virtuous. And thank you so much for your work in this field. I hope that too long exposition is of some value.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know if you had a question per se, but I will just comment on, I know you said it sort of flippantly, everything's a cult, which I think is true. And also there's a flip side to that. I just want to, it's not a but, it's an and. One of the things we talk about on our podcast is just looking at how it has become sort of, the word has lost its potency because they're like, oh, I'm going to this yoga class, it's a little bit culty. And like, you know, not everything is a destructive cult. There's a lot of things that are a little bit culty. So what the way that I like to talk about it now, and people say like, well, what is a cult? And I say, and I actually am writing a second book, more so not memoir, but more about what we've learned a little bit culty, how to distill all the nuggets. But one of the things I like to say is that these are like systems of control in different areas with our behavior, with our, and Stephen Hassan taught me this initially, and we've kind of got our own spin on it. But our goal is to say, like, look at the dynamics that are happening in the group. Is it healthy for you? And can you speak up and ask questions without being gaslit? Can you leave without being excommunicated? What happens when you go onto the internet and say, is something a cult, and something pops up? How do the leaders respond to that? Do they say everybody's crazy and it's just jilted lovers? Like, I want to show the patterns and the red flags, and then you can educate yourself. Because the thing is, we're not educated. And just because a yoga studio gives you a 24-hour discount to sign up for something, that's a high-pressure sales tactic, doesn't make it a cult. You know what I mean? But you still may want to leave because maybe you don't want to be pressured into sales at a yoga studio. So I want to give people tools to figure out what they can do to still be seekers. Like I was a seeker, and didn't mention that when I said I got into Nexium. I was a very open seeker, and I'd done a lot of different things. I was very, very open, somehow managed to skim around the surface of a lot of what turned out to be quite culty things like Bikram yoga. I'd been invited to Landmark, Course of Miracles, all sorts of different things, which are problematic in different ways. But my point is that when we say everything's a cult, it kind of diminishes the ability to say what actually is bad about certain groups. And I think that's what you're saying. I wasn't disagreeing with you, just to pontificate on that line of thinking.
Yeah, thank you very much. You mentioned Seeker. There was a cult in Culpeper, Virginia called the Finders.
This is not on my radar, which is rare.
But what you said is very similar to what a former student of mine in Moscow, who I always talk with, said on this same subject, which is, well, some cults open your mind to learn new things, and some close your mind and shut it off from learning new things. But then the problem is every cult does some of both. But the problem is the balance, the degree, how vicious it is. So there are criteria, as you say, that they have to be evaluated empirically and understand that there's good and bad in every person and in every group.
Yeah. Well, I think I do find it so interesting that even among cult experts, there isn't a succinct definition. Yeah. And well, I talk about that I'm only in the proposal stage, but we do talk about that, how it's given that some people say it's this and some people say it's that, here's what we say, and you know, go for it. Anyway, any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Go ahead, Mars.
Thank you, Yasmin. There's a question I have for you regarding cults, but I think this one has to deal with more like mass hysteria than anything else. I don't want to bring this subject back to what's I think is on everyone's mind, but what happened in Israel this last week. It hit differently this year because I went to Israel several months ago as part of a delegation, and it felt very, very different because I was there and whatnot. And as someone who's very, very outspoken against critical race theory and what it's doing to how it's just deranging people who I thought share the same values of humanism. I think it's something that people need to be talked out of. But okay, so what's my question? One of my most favorite intellectuals, Sam Harris, believes that people can be talked out of delusions. I'm no longer convinced that's the case. What is your opinion on this? Can people be talked out of extreme beliefs? Can people be reasoned out of these ideologies? I'm not so sure it can be done.
I actually don't know if they can be talked out of it. I think that, at least from what I've experienced, we call it waking up. You can call it whatever, like when you sort of see the other side. And again, to everything we've been talking about, whether you're talking about Israel, critical race theory, state of politics, everything is so divided right now. You're either this or you're that. And the binariness of that so-called duality is so divisive. That's the us and the them. And this is something that, like, I've been doing cult recovery for 6 years. I've only recently just heard this term. You could hold two things in your mind at once. You could hold deep grieving for the people of Israel and also deep empathy for the people of Palestine, and it's not separate. You know what I mean? Like, and people can't quite grasp that, and it's infuriating. And I think that until people have an experience of it, when something's very intellectual, you can do that. You can do that on Twitter. You can do that when you're reading, and you can be othered and other people very, very easily. But when you have a personal experience of it and with it, it changes things. And I think that anytime I've seen anybody wake up from an extreme ideology of any kind, is they have to get some sort of counter information in that's not an intellectual thing. It's almost like they have to have a feel. They have to have a feeling around it that goes deeper. And I'll just give you some stories of what I saw with Nexium, just to relate it back to this, like, because we left, and when we left, like, hundreds, maybe thousands, I don't even know the numbers, people came with us and left and, like, denounced Keith, and they were like, wow, this is really bad. Like, they're branding people with Keith's initials. The people that stayed were so righteous about their beliefs that Keith is good. Keith is a good man. And these are people that had devoted more. Maybe they were sleeping with him, or they moved to Albany, or they'd given up more. They'd cut themselves away from their family, so they were more isolated. They were more righteous. And for them to go, oh shit, I fucked up by believing in this thing, or Keith, substitute Keith for critical race theory, for Hamas, or whatever. Like, they believe in something wholeheartedly. They cut off all other options to the outside world. And so they have to stick with that belief system, right? And so some of those people, and they're still happening now, 6 years later, still waking up to the reality that Keith is a liar and a sociopathic con man. They had to have their own experience of that in many ways. Like, there was leaders that were up high rank as me, Green Sash, who left maybe a year after me because they hadn't seen it for themselves. They didn't get branded, right? They were like a couple of men, leaders in Mexico, who are friends of mine now, but they've told me that they had to have their own experience of Keith lying to them for them to go, oh, Keith is a liar. You have to like have that themselves. You have to have that yourself. It's like an experiential aha, you know? So I don't know how to reach people in some of the other, you know, content specific things we're talking about, only hope that they will have like some sort of empathy based human experience that shows the other side, that they could go, oh, that's interesting, which is like never going to happen when you're so divided and speaking in an echo chamber about anything. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's like why I'm so excited to talk to Yasmin, because like, when else is this going to happen? And so many of the people that I know who are divided on either side are just, you know, sharing posts within their own sides.
And even if they do have that moment, they're going to do that thing that you did when you were lying down ready to get branded, where they're going to start doubting themselves and doing this thing like, oh, I'm being weak, or I'm wrong, or how dare I have these questions, you know?
Right. Like in the Mormon church, one of their lines is doubt your doubts. Mm-hmm. Like basically saying, don't trust your intuition. And in Christian faith, it's that Satan. That's just the voice of Satan. Intuition is your voice of Satan. You're right.
Yeah.
So we're screwed.
Yeah.
And when, then when you throw in righteousness on top of that, and that's one of the things that drives me crazy about just the state of, I don't know, I don't even know what you call it, the Western world, like the state of the division of the Western world. Like, and I'm from Canada, and now I'm living in Atlanta, and it's like, everyone wants to label it like, what is she, a Republican or a Democrat? Like,
yeah,
what, you know, I'm like, what the fuck is the matter with you? Like, I'm a person. We're like, our kids go to the same school. Can we, you know, was she vaccinated or unvaccinated? I need to know. Like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah.
So divided. Anyway, I did see a question from earlier that I wouldn't mind digging into from Nazreen about, she said, this is what I'm currently thinking of. And this is when we were talking about the conflict in the Middle East. Is it religious extremism on both sides to blame, or is it fully political and about power? Because you'll find a lot of religious Jews and Muslims advocating for peace and denouncing their government and elected ones. She says that she could argue for both of those. What do you think? Do you think it's
Nazreen's got her hand up, so I'm going to let her jump in and have the discussion with you, actually.
Sure.
I don't want to
I can't see her. Let me change
monopolize.
My view here.
No worries.
Hi. Hi, Yasmeen. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Pleasure to meet you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice to meet you. Yeah. So, basically that's my question, because, you know, a lot of people talk about anti-Semitism, and I know, especially over the past few years, I think before this, I didn't really know, I like grew up in Kuwait, right? And I've not met, I'd say, I think any Jews or any Israelis, maybe a couple of Israelis when I was in India for a break. And so I've just been in this bubble. But then online, I've met like a lot of anti-Zionist Jews and those who are advocating for peace, two states. But I also know that a lot of us who are, you know, who understand or who have a lot of Palestinian friends and know their stories, their grandparents' stories, are also not coming at it from a place of hating the other, like hating Judaism or Jews. But I know there are some who use it in that way. Like, I know there's, you know, folks in my community who talk about Yehud, and which is the Arabic term for Jews. So I know some of them. And then I've also seen, I think even on the Jewish side, there are people who look at it from a religious angle, and it's probably how Israel was also set up to be like a religious ethnostate. But then, so I'm just wondering, did Israel come up that way with the religious, like truly believing that that's the land that they were destined to be in? Or was that just used? Was the religion just used to, you know, meet their political goals? And the same way is Hamas and a lot of these factions who are in power, they're using religion to sort of shore up these emotions in people and just letting it get really heated on both sides.
You know what? I feel like I'm not educated enough to say exactly, to be honest, and I don't want to say the wrong thing, but my instinct is that it's almost always both. I certainly know that there's like religious, right-wing religious Jews who believe that like they were there first, you know, that's where Jesus was from, the Jews live there, blah blah blah. Does that make it okay to take back the land? I mean, we're talking about land claims now. We have a lot of land to return in many different places, and I don't know how. I don't have an answer for it, you know what I mean? Like, I don't, like, I just, my husband just showed me this clip. I don't know if you see this or where you live now, but in Canada specifically, anytime we have an event, like at a play or any sort of gathering, someone stands up and says, I want, needs to be acknowledged that we stand on the, what's the language? I haven't heard it in a while.
Unceded territory of the Algonquin people or the whoever people.
Swahili Tooth, the Kakuta, all these different people. And then they sit down and we go on the show. And my husband, who's from America, is like, wait, we're just going to announce that? Are we giving it back?
Yeah.
What are we doing here? Like,
I just wanted to remind you.
Yeah, I should remind you. And I just saw this.
So we're on your land, okay?
Right, anyway. We're on your land. Okay, now, is that enough? Like, I just, the land thing, I don't have a solution. We all have to live here. We have to figure it out. And, you know, I've been trying to educate myself better to the history, because I know the history that I learned because I went to a socialist Zionist Jewish youth camp growing up, summer camp. Mm-hmm. not like camp, like a summer camp where we also went to, I lived in Israel for a year, but I believed we were pro-peace. We mingled with Arabs. We had peace discussions. How can we all live together? I didn't identify as a Zionist in the way that I see it being spoken about now. But if I was a parent, I would never send my kid there because that's a dogma that I don't think is appropriate to teach to kids, whether it's right or wrong. I don't want my kids learning dogma at summer camp. I'm gonna get shit for that from my camp friends. Anyway, my opinion. Sorry, have to have them. Great camp though, in other ways. Learned a lot of things, but that not appropriate. But what I was gonna say was, sorry, I'm tangenting all over the place. I said, what were you just saying?
Land
Land.
claims.
I don't know. I don't remember what I was answering. Oh yeah, so there's people who believe that, and there's other people that believe that this land was at the time that the Jews got it back, or whatever you want to call it, in 48, I believe, that they could have all lived in peace, and many people did want to live in peace, and up until even last week, Jews, Arabs, Muslims, Christians, gay people, you know, it's a Democrat. It's a Democratic state. And that's the only state that does that in the entire region. And it's not just for the Jews. It's a, I feel like we said we weren't going to do this and now I'm doing it, but I don't want to get political. I don't want to get political. I just want it to express that, like, as a Western cultural Jew who's here, it's so complicated. I don't even know how to answer the question. Is that
It is a complicated question, but you did a great job of explaining how complicated it is. And this is why you can't really give it a clear answer on either side. If I were to talk about the Muslim side, I would sound the same as you. I would just be like, well, I know that Hamas is using religious doctrine to further their terrorism, but other Muslims can look at religious doctrine and then find reasons to be peaceful from it, and then groups like Hamas and other Islamic terrorist organizations are not necessarily even religious sometimes. It's not about faith, it's about power and control and what is the thing that they can use to control the masses. And that's quite often religion. So it's a big, big, ugly mess, but I don't know if that really clarified things for you, Nazreen, but Oleg says he has the answer, so I'm curious to know what it is.
Oleg, please tell us the answer.
Hello?
Yep, we hear you.
Well, I don't think I have the answer, but it is an answer. Well, from what I've read, that the process of people coming to Israel. Well, generally speaking, before the government here formed, obviously there was always people here, like Jewish people, there were North African people, Arabic people. But from what I understood, there was swamps here, and like early, there wasn't much of anything here. By the way, I live in Israel, that's why I'm saying that it's here.
I hope you're okay, Oleg, and everybody in your family is safe. I know it's a very difficult time for everybody, but especially for people who are actually living in Israel or Gaza right now.
Yeah, we've had like a bomb alarm this morning.
Oh.
And anyway, a part of the reason, basically, it's a whole history. Like two of the people who were most influential was Theodor Herzl from Hungary, not Hungary, Germany, I think. And there
The
was,
first Zionists.
yeah, there was also Zev Jabotinsky, who was from Ukraine, from Odessa. Both of them were influential, and so they had different ideas of it. But Herzl was from what I understood, he ended up being more influential. Basically, there was the Dreyfus affair, where the French officer got accused of selling information to Germany, and basically the whole mess where the French didn't want, they put him to jail and didn't want to have what's the word? Well, basically, they tried to cover it up. Eventually, Herzl and many other people decided that there needs to be like a Jewish government where people will escape all of this type of stuff, the persecution. And I think I've seen like a video of a conference with Zev Jabotinsky, like in black and white, speaking about it. That was also either somewhere in Europe. And the whole, from what I understood, even the Israel itself, the land was not initially considered. So I think I've read some people considered Uganda, some people considered like South America. But that kind of all of it fell apart after Zev, not Zev, what was it? Herzl passed away. Huh?
Yeah, sorry, go on.
Herzl passed away, then eventually it turned to Israel. And then the process started where people started to come here, and that was then the Ottoman Empire fell apart.
Yeah.
And then
I think the story is long and
yes.
complicated. Yeah, I appreciate you trying to make it concise for us, but it really is a big
yeah.
story.
Yeah,
and I think at the end of the day, any country has a story like that, fraught with all sorts of issues. You know, most of us are Canadian and American on this call, and we have very similar, you know, beginnings to our countries as well. But at the end of the day, this is where we are today. And so we have to make it work today.
Basically, it's a whole mess.
It's a whole mess. And one thing I'll say, like, I just Googled it while you were talking. And like, even Zionism is not like, you can say Muslim is not one thing. Like, Zionism is political. There's political Zionism, liberal
religious
Zionism, labor Zionism, revisionist Zionism, cultural Zionism, religious. And by the way, our group was a labor Zionist, which is the more left-wing, pro-peace, collaboration. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like, when someone says you're a Zionist, it's like, what does that even mean? Like, pro-Israel, we were always raised like pro-Israel, pro-collaboration, peace in the Middle East. Like, let's live together. We're brothers, sisters. So that's the other thing, is like, I don't identify with a lot of what I, it's complicated. I'm not going to talk about it anymore.
Also, I wanted to ask another question, which is kind of related to cults. First of all, I wouldn't really quite define myself as a seeker, but like, the stuff about yoga and meditation that interests me in different groups. And somewhat recently, I've come across a group which I ended up like leaving because they did have some cult-like aspects to them. Like, for example, there was a charismatic leader which they told me that I should read only his books and only accept ideas that are his, and even if it's something that's related to his stuff, I shouldn't read it if it's not him saying it,
right?
Which is very weird. Like, what other things should I look out for, because I'd like to avoid it in the future.
Yeah, I mean, anything that says it's the way or the only way, and everyone else is wrong, is definitely a red flag. I'm just going to pull up my book proposal because this is in there.
And like you mentioned before, if you're part of it and they don't allow you to question or criticize, right, Sarah? I think that was one of the points you were making before.
if you bring up a question and it goes back to you and it's your fault, your problem, you feel shame, any shame involved in expressing any of your concerns, that should be a big red flag. Looking at to see what happens with people who leave. Are they shunned? Are they excommunicated? Do they get ridiculed or cut off by the community? Are they welcome to come back?
Are they executed?
Are they executed? That's number one red flag right there.
That's a red, green, and black and white flag. Anyway, sorry.
All the rainbow.
Let me see here. I know I just made a list, so I wanted to show it to you. Hold on one second. So we talked about questioning, we talk about leaving, we talk about if you're feeling like love bombed. So when you get join a group, and just because someone's being nice and kind to you doesn't necessarily mean they are love bombing you. People say welcome to the family, eye gazing, deep eye gazing. Encouraging to distance yourself from members who don't get it. When there's language that's specifically loaded with thought terminating cliches. So like, I don't know what it is in Islam, but like in, well, yeah, from reading your book, I would say when your mother said things like, you're not trusting God, like, how could you, do you think you're better than God? That stops your inquiry, and then you're like shamed into no longer thinking about it. That's called a thought terminating cliche. We've talked about this already, black and white thinking, good versus evil, like us and theming. Anyone saying, yeah, I spoke to Jesus, I spoke to God, this is what we got to do. When people are talking and this sounds like what's called word salad, you can't understand them, it just doesn't make any sense, and you're smiling and nodding and everyone else is smiling and nodding, that's a red flag. And anyone who presents themselves as an ultimate authority and has outrageous claims about their abilities and what they're capable of and what they can do is a, should be a red flag. But also, and I see this in now in a lot of contemporary gurus and spirituality, is there's sort of this faux humbleness, like, I'm not anyone's guru, don't pedestalize me, I'm just a human. Meanwhile there's like pictures of them everywhere and it's like, really, you're really that humble? So then, and then there's other things that are like across the board, like sleep deprivation, lots of rituals and ceremonies, long hours, repetition, controlling diet, food, drink, clothes. You have to ask permission to make big decisions, promoting feelings of guilt or unworthiness. And any school or program that you can never graduate from, like it's a never-ending thing. And also with the bar that keeps changing, a moving target, like, okay, well, you just have to do this to get your goal. But that's actually, no, you got to do this. And there's also lots of resources out there about what traits of narcissism are, which most of these leaders have in spades.
Beautiful.
Can I actually ask you a question? Well,
Yes.
sorry for Yasmin and Nazreen or anyone who's like raised in the Middle East who can educate me on something. Because
Yeah, of course.
I feel like a prevalent belief that I just want to question for myself and get your perspective. Is that because I'm always trying to like not be dogmatic in my own belief system? Is that because this is on the tail of your question, Israel? Like, how did this happen? Like, what do the people of Israel believe? And I think that from what I've seen, like, because there's one Israeli state and there's, I think, 52 Arab
Correct.
nations, like, around it, and every war that there has been against
Almost the
Israel.
majority ones, but yeah,
Okay,
the Arab ones are just like 26.
yeah. So one thing that I've sort of like heard is like that the Arab states don't want the Palestinians and they use them as pawns to or human shields to protect their land. And so, I mean, or to get the land back or to as or like negotiating to get Israel back. So is that do you think that's true? Is that something that Westerners have adopted to make it okay to go to war? Like, where does that come from? And do you think it's accurate?
Westerners.
I
Sorry.
can respond to that.
Please.
If you look at Lebanon and how Lebanon was before it let in a whole bunch of Palestinian refugees, and then it led to a civil war and Christians being massacred, and there was a lot of empathy for Palestinian people at the very beginning. of, you know, Israel forming. And what has happened over the years, especially in places like Kuwait, I think there was a, like, they felt that they were betrayed by the Palestinian people who had joined their country because they didn't fight in the war with them. Like, they felt like they didn't really have allegiance to Kuwait. They still had just allegiance to
Saddam.
That's what it was. Yeah. Yeah. So they felt like, what, after everything we did for you, and then this is how you repay us. So there are a lot of negative, let me tell you, Sarah, I think I mentioned this in the book, but I'm not sure if I did, but when I went to Egypt, my cousins would tell me, do not tell anybody that you're half Palestinian. And I was like, why not? And she's like, because Palestinians are the beggars. They're the beggars of the Arab world. They just go around begging for things. They can't do anything for themselves. So that's their neighbors in Egypt saying that. That's the reputation that they have there. They are treated badly in almost every Arab country that they go in as refugees. If they go in like every, you know, like as immigrants, skilled, working, like, you know, in Jordan or something, or in Saudi Arabia, then they're maybe not dealing with as much bigotry. But there is definitely negative feelings towards Palestinians from a lot of Arab people.
Yeah. Okay. So I recognize that it's 1:30 and my kid's going to be dropped off any second, but I so want to keep talking about this. Please, will you come? I know we scheduled it for like January.
I will.
You come like next week or soon. And
I will definitely be there. Can I beg you to just answer Lois's question?
Yes, of course.
She's such a kind, loving, wonderful human being. And she's been waiting so patiently. So
yes,
go ahead, Lois.
I'll make it as quick as I can. It's almost a follow-up on Mara's question. And I've said this to other groups, but I'm always, I keep wondering what makes some people able to leave a high control cult, religion, whatever, and other people don't, even when there's not much difference. And I'll try to make this fast. I have a sister who's still a very devout, you know, fundamentalist Christian. I left, she didn't, and everything about our lives was so similar. And then I also know a couple, well, I know the man, who went through a horrendous experience. And, well, they were captured. They went to Mexico to vacation, and they were captured, tied up, taken, everything taken from. Anyway, she went the way direction of becoming devout Christian because of that. He became an atheist because of it. And so they had the same experience, went opposite directions. And if we could understand why people go the directions they do, we might be able to help more people. And do you have any perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's case by case. I think, I don't know your sister and your case well enough, but I would say, at least for me, I had more to lose on the outside world. So I had more connection with the outside world. I had one foot in reality, and I had a community to go back to, and I had friends and family who never gave up on me. And so I had like a safe place to land in many ways. There's people who don't get out because of nowhere else to go. Like, if you look at the people who stayed loyal to Keith Raniere after I left, had given up pretty much everything. And they were also very prideful about their being like the last one standing, about being in many ways like the chosen ones of Keith Raniere, like his loyal army. So sometimes, like, even though your life circumstances might be same, like your sister might feel more pride about staying, or on the flip side, shame about leaving. You know, a lot of people wake up from cultic abuse, high demand groups, high control religion, extreme religion, and they're so ashamed, even like what Yasmin was talking about at the beginning, like learning to forgive herself and not leaving sooner, because you're like, knowing what you know now, it's hard to not say, wow, I was so stupid for not seeing the red flags, you know, and it's very common that because of that shame, we don't want to tell anybody. And that's why I think Yasmin is so brave. Oh, you're muted.
I was going to say, and you don't want to admit it, and you don't want to admit it to yourself. So you'd rather just keep believing than have to deal with that fact.
Yeah. Yeah, so you stay, and that's also honestly why so many of these things existed for so long and continue to exist, is because people are leaving. Maybe they'll wake up, but they're so ashamed. Now, why someone chooses Christianity versus becoming an atheist, I don't know. I don't know if enough about it, but I would say there's something in both of those dogmas that offered the person hope. Maybe an atheist going, well, there is no God, that's why I got kidnapped and tied up, and that makes me feel better, and it's just happenstance. And somebody might go, well, there is a God, which is why it happened, and that makes me feel better knowing there's a God and he put me through this situation, and now I'm back and now I have a purpose, and thank you, Jesus. So
it's,
I don't know, case by case. Either way, people need to cling on to something to make sense of stuff, and what they cling on to will be different. Does that help?
Yes, thanks. I'm just trying to figure out how to, if we can understand the difference, we might be able to help more people. That's
yeah. I think to help more people, regardless of what it is to be non-judgmental, to be empathetic and ask questions and to be there for someone. And when they're ready to, they'll have a safe place to go and be like, you know, I always wondered why I never left this church and you did. Why did you leave? And you're being the person being like, you know, sister, I respect your journey and we had such different paths and we still love each other or whatever it is. And then she won't feel judged, because the people who are in these things feel judged because also they're judging themselves. The cognitive dissonance is so high. And it's like the tension is so high when people are like, you're in a cult. They're like, you don't understand and you don't get me. And they close down even further. So there's so many things you should not do. Yeah. So I think, you know, keeping that lifeline open, and that I learned that from Stephen Hassan also.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you for taking extra time with us. I really want to take a moment to tell you that you're such an empathetic and loving and kind person. Your heart is so huge. You're also hilarious and really fun. And I absolutely adore you. And I'm so, so glad that we've had this opportunity to chat. And I'm really looking forward to coming on your podcast. And you know what, like, I've read your book, I've watched you on the two seasons of The Vow and everything. So I've already, you know, adored you, but I just can't believe like how much more, I have so much more respect and love for you after this conversation. And I'm really, really grateful that our paths have crossed.
I'm so grateful too. I just am so touched by all the things you just said, and can't wait for more. And I'm really like, just please be safe. I know what you're doing is dangerous and it's very brave, and I'm honored to know you and to call you a friend.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Before I let you go, is there a final word that you want to say to everybody? Let them know where they can find you or where they can follow A Little Bit Culty.
Yeah, A Little Bit Culty, anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'm on Instagram at Sarah Edmondson. A Little Bit Culty is also on Instagram. I also did a TED Talk that drops on Thursday, which covers exciting. A lot of this. Yeah. And I just got that date. So it drops Thursday. I'll make sure to share it with you. And I think though I don't necessarily say the things that we talked about, it's still relevant. And I hope it lands now. Yeah. Thank you for giving me a place to work out some of these feelings, everybody. And and the book. Sorry, the book's on anywhere you listen to books or read books. I narrated the Audible, so you can have my voice in your ear. But a lot of the podcasts that we discover explores many of the topics we talked about today. So skip the ones that don't resonate, share the ones that do, and hopefully we can keep this conversation going.
Love it. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you
everybody for joining us, and looking forward to that TED Talk. Take care, everyone.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.